In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with sports science and nutrition consultant Dr. Derek Wilcox. Derek and I speak about the benefits of the abduction or belt squat machine, how carbs impact performance, and how to get rid of stubborn belly fat. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Derek, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Derek. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Derek Wilcox. He's a sports science and nutrition consultant and the lightest person to ever squat 1,000 pounds. Welcome to the show, Derek.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Super excited to speak with you about all things strength training, resistance training, and just generally physique science, I guess, today. But first of all, I want to hear more about you and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I started off as a child, as most of us do. Now, I was always heavily influenced by my father with his love for athletics and my love for athletics and playing in them and eventually figuring out the nuts and bolts of it, how it all works. I always appreciated strategy a lot. And as I got older and got exposed to the sciences, I'm like, wait a minute, there's this whole other realm of athletics that people don't seem to really understand that well. And that's the actual science behind it all. It's the physics and the physiology and the kinetics. And there's all those things. There's so many things to tinker with. And I think having a big love for motorsports as well, because I understood the mechanics and things with cars and performance and stuff like that. I was like, there's so many parallels between it all. And it's so much fun. So figuring out the variables that increase performance or increase body composition and the ways that you want it. There's so many cool things to do. It's a brand new puzzle with every single person I work with. And that's basically what led to all my education. I started off with exercise science courses. I ended up being disillusioned with that in undergrad. I finished with a religious studies major, though. So, but that got me into grad school, which was good enough, where I had my master's in sport kinesiology, and then later in the same program, a PhD in sport physiology and performance.
Very cool. Awesome. And so since then, you have started your own company, Wilcox Strength, as far as I'm aware, and you mostly work with athletes, or do you also work with Gen Pop? What's your clientele?
That's the best thing for me. I'm a people person. I love increasing people's quality of life. That's the basis of everything I do as a coach. So it doesn't matter to me if I'm working with a child or with the elderly or with a complete non-athlete that just wants to be able to get up off the couch a little bit better, or if I'm working with somebody that's going to the Olympics. And fortunately, I subcontract through RP Strength, Renaissance Periodization, and I get to work with so many different kinds of people who sign up through them as well, on top of my own clientele with Wilcox Strength. So it's been super rewarding in that way, because it doesn't matter to me if somebody's, you know, lifting a world record like I did, or they just look in the mirror and they're happier and they can play with their kids better. Every quality of life increase to me is really the same. So it all brings me joy.
Oh, I love that. What a wonderful why. And you touched on your world record there. Of course, you only brushed over it, but I do want to get into it and like into your own training as well. You said it always made sense to you and you wanted to figure out more like how the body functions and works. But have you always been into sports, I assume, in high school or in college or whatever as well? Or how was your own personal evolution?
Yeah, for sure. I really enjoy the competitive aspect of sports a lot. When I was playing in different sports, whether it was football, golf, you know, I grew up playing baseball and basketball as well. But I started figuring out as soon as I got into high school that it wasn't just a component of how hard you were willing to work and the attitude that you brought to the game. There had to be talent and skill at some point. And I'm 5'7". I'm not going to go to the NBA, and I'm probably not going to go to the NFL either. And then lo and behold, I wasn't that good at baseball. I was never the biggest person on the field, and I graduated high school at 155 pounds, and I gained weight as much as I could through that entire time period. So I knew I wasn't going to be the big, strong, overbearing person that could dominate sports that way. And I had to start figuring out, as I really fell in love with lifting weights, and competing in lifting weights, especially all forms of it, Powerlifting was what I was best at, but I competed in Highland Games still, competed in some strongman shows, Olympic weightlifting, all those things. It's just a lot of fun and I love it. And a lot of the people that I admired as a young athlete did all those things as well, like Mikhail Kuklaev is a great example of that. But there were so many factors that went into those things that I understood I didn't have the great genetics that a lot of the best lifters in the world did. So I had to figure out other avenues to find competitive advantage. And through that is where I really got into kinesiology and physiology and discovering training methods that would work for me. And it was really a tortoise in the hare kind of situation where I had to figure out how little I needed to train to still make progress, because I was born with a joint dysplasia. So my body would not withstand a lot of hard training. I couldn't just go crazy all the time and recover like people with great genetics do. I had to be very meticulous and play things by ear. If my body started telling me that it's not feeling good, I really had to listen or I wouldn't be able to train at all. So discovering all those little nuanced things through my own process and having the passionate endeavor to compete, where everything that I did was focused around competing and being the best lifter that I could be, I accumulated the knowledge and the wisdom, which is, just the information plus the experience, to put it another way, to help the people that I work with now. And I always encourage people to try and find people to work with if they're looking for a coach that have both of those things. You have to have somebody that really selfishly wanted to learn all those things about physiology and the ways to improve that you don't get the uptake of knowledge or the understanding of it unless you are doing it for selfish reasons, in my opinion at least. And when you have somebody that's done that, they understand how intimate the process is, the ups and downs, they know what you're going to feel when you're going to feel it and why. So I think that's always the best way to go when working with a coach. And I try to do that as best I can for my clients. And I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Like just that combination of knowledge and experience, and nonetheless, you added another layer to that, which was simply sort of trial and error. Because even if we know a lot and we do our client intake thoroughly, I don't think we would truly find out something like your low training volume tolerance, unless we experiment with that. So I think it's so important as a coach to also say that to your client, actually, like, hey, this is what we're starting off with, but there is a really good chance that we're going to adapt things over time because I don't actually know your body. Like, I can, get my best assessment possible, but I don't actually know your body yet. So I'm curious when you have a client intake. I assume most or some of them are remote, some of them perhaps in person. I'm not sure, but if you have an intake, are they generally the same or similar? How do you go about it?
It's primarily remote these days. When I was in grad school, part of our program in the sports science program at ETSU, East Tennessee State, was working in person with all the athletes. You immediately get assigned to a team to work with. So you've got constant athletes that you have to work with one-on-one or in the team setting. So you're always coaching that way. But I've worked with, God, probably over 1,000 athletes just from that experience. That were going in and out. And then I was eventually supervisor of all those programs for the Center of Excellence there. And now I work mostly remote. I still have a few athletes I work with in person. But first, you have to figure out how to listen and to speak their language. Communication is paramount in coaching. You can't just have somebody jump into your program and do the things that you say. Half the time, they're probably not going to understand the nomenclature that you're using. So you have to figure out how to communicate with them. Especially when they are a paying client, because that puts them in the CEO position of the whole process. You work for them. So you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's so true. And like learning to speak that language, so to speak, extends beyond just their expertise, but also some people need a little bit of a harsher treatment, I guess. Other need a little bit more soft guidance. And I think that really takes some time to figure out, like, what kind of person am I dealing with here? Is it someone who really can deal with kind of like the shit sandwich where we tell them, something that they did well, something that they didn't do so well, and something that they did well, or someone who's just like, hey, I know you can do better. This was like pretty shit last week, to be honest. So I think, yeah, it takes some time to like really figure out what they respond to well. And yeah, you have such wonderful information on your social media as well, where you try to help other people, or like everybody, I guess. And that's great, extending your reach even further. Something that really spoke to me when I looked through your content was that you mentioned the abduction machine or exercises, to get into the specifics of the training aspect here. Because I, for many, many years, well, first of all, I just kind of neglected machines in general, and I just said like free weights is always better, you know, super like narrow-minded. Because of that though, my abductors were like very underdeveloped, and I developed some sciatic nerve issues as well. And so like just all in all, my hip girdle was not very strong at all. And so since then, maybe the last 2.5 years, I've been really working on that and using a lot of abduction machines and exercises. And I cannot tell you that, well, you probably presume the difference that it has made. Otherwise, you would not have made this post. But yeah, what prompted you to speak about the abduction machine, and why is it actually so beneficial?
Well, it was very specific for me because it fit into all the wide stance work that I did in powerlifting. And most of the time you see people using the abduction and adduction machines, they're just kind of trying to get a burn in those muscles. But specifically, way I do it and a way I have my clients do it is we're trying to mimic our squat form to a large degree there, because the pelvic tilt and the angle of the attack from origin to insertion of those adductor muscles and abductor muscles as well drastically changes when you are in the bottom of a squat, when you really, really need to be able to get your knees spread out wide. This also has a massive impact on injury risk for the low back, because if your adductors are tight in the bottom, specifically adductor magnus, which has twin origin points, one down low, where it actually functions more like a hamstring or a hip extension muscle, and then the other up higher, where it is more of a true adduction form or force. But when you put both of those together, they kind of have a 45 degree downward angle that they pull on the knee at. So when you see people coming out of the bottom of a squat and those knees shoot down immediately, that's partly the reason why. It's probably the largest muscle that pulls that direction. So if it's tight and your abductors on the outside of the hip are weak, then you're going to have that valgus collapse. So it's super, super important for all my field athletes, especially the ladies who have severe Q angle problems, are at high risk for ACL tears and things like that. But if you just want to maximize your force output and efficiency, you have to have mobile hips to hold good position.
Very interesting. I was not aware of those two insertion points actually. And I mean, beyond the abductors, I think that machine is just brilliant also for like the glute medius and just different areas of the glute, depending on how we target them. But yeah, you had another machine that you mentioned, and that's the belt squat, or well, not necessarily a machine, but a sort of a machine. Why do you think the belt squat is so beneficial as well to incorporate in one's training program versus just quote unquote regular squats or hack squats or Smith machine squats or anything?
Well, it's really what the leg press is supposed to be in theory. It's a way to train your legs, ideally in a full range of motion, with really heavy loads without all the axial loading fatigue that comes with barbell squats. So we can basically set all the load on the hips, and your legs still get the brunt of the force, basically 100% of that load. But your spine and everything throughout your back and posture muscles and all those things that also get heavily fatigued during barbell squats, which is basically the king of all exercises, in my opinion. But you avoid so many of those bad effects or more negative effects that really hinder your leg strength and development. It doesn't matter if you're a bodybuilder, power lifter, field athlete, whatever. There are a lot of times that you want to give your back a break. And if you have specific weaknesses in your legs, that's the best answer in the world. You get to work your legs without affecting the fatigue that's onset with everything else that you're already doing. So it's just a great, great concept for sure.
Yeah, I think especially in the strength sport, it's Even more so than in hypertrophy, I believe it's probably about managing that central nervous system load so that we can train or find our optimal and maximal training volume, perhaps. Yeah, definitely, not everybody, or probably very, very few people, can barbell squat every single day, or even just 6 days a week or 5 days a week. So it's great to have some alternatives like that, or like the leg press. And with the leg press, I have found that some people, probably also due to tightness issues or so, that they just cannot, they start rounding their lower back, for instance, or they don't feel it in their glutes at all. It's just the legs. It also depends on the angle of the leg press that they're using at their gym. And so I think it's great having alternatives like a belt squat or so.
Definitely. And I honestly have never programmed a leg press for anyone in my life because of those problems. Most of the time, when people can't do a decent back squat already, they tend to just go on the leg press and do the work that they can there. And guess what? The work, their form on the leg press is 10 times worse than the barbell squat. So you end up with that, spinal flexion issue where I always tell people, this will be crass, but easy to remember. Think about the angle that your butthole is shooting out at. If you've got a laser coming out of your butt, what angle is that laser going to be shooting at? So if it's not going at least straight back behind you, or maybe even slightly up if you have an arch in your low back, like before a squat or a Romanian deadlift, whatever, that's the dictation of your hips, but that's also the dictation of your lower spine. So if you're getting a large horizontal pressure or force while your lower spine is in massive amount of flexion and you don't have strong posture to begin with, that's a recipe for a back injury. So that's why we see, people like Dr. Mike and Jared, everybody at RP, they have to manufacture completely different angles on the leg press with using lots of pads and changing all kinds of dynamics to where they use a lot less load, which is optimal. They have it get a really big range of motion, but they're basically not even using the machine anymore. It's compounding so many different factors that I can't really trust my clients very well to go do that. You can't set that up correctly. It's hard enough to get people to do form without any, special setups and things like that. But I think we can get super, super good work with all the different squat variations, especially a belt squat, that we don't really need to do that. But that's just me.
Yeah, I actually, because not many gyms that I have gone to, unfortunately, have a belt squat machine. And in preparation for this episode, I was also like looking into how to manufacture your own belt squat machine. There's actually some pretty decent variations with a cable machine. I have seen
Oh,
them.
yeah.
It might not be the same, especially not if you're a very strong individual power lifter training for performance or so. But, for the sort of everyday kind of person, I would say that that's probably sufficient. So, yeah, I might put some variations there in the show notes for people to look at as well. But I'm curious, what does your training look like personally these days? Do you still compete at anything? How many times per week do you train? How long do you spend in the gym?
Well, my training always kind of changes because just like periodization infers, there are different phases of what I'm doing all the time. And I've kind of fallen into a cycle where I still compete in Highland Games, but I also compete in jiu-jitsu, but I also compete in disc golf tournaments from time to time as well. So all those things have parallels as far as force development helps. So being strong allows you to compete in a lot of different things more effectively than otherwise. So I have that trait in my back pocket that I get to use and exploit. But jiu-jitsu, I tend to not lift as much, especially close to competition. I think before Masters World Championships last year, I didn't lift at all for almost 2 months. But I already had so much strength built up that force production wasn't going to be what was holding me back in jiu-jitsu. It's just my jiu-jitsu sucks. So I had to work on that a lot. But Highland Games is very much a force output sport because the implements are very heavy. We throw a 56-pound weight for distance and for height over our heads. So we have to be able to produce a lot of force with those heavy implements. So I do work on my lower body strength quite a bit and mostly explosiveness because I am much stronger statically than I am explosive at this point in my life as well. So I don't lift the heavy weights that I used to by any means. I don't lift half what I used to, but I'm always working on trying to get more explosive and more mobile, particularly for jujitsu. I'm still doing splits and all kinds of stretches and working full range of motions on things like side lunges, which I think are super important for all athletes that move around at all. So I'm always focusing on mobility, explosiveness, and upper body wise. I've got to make videos with my shirts off. So I still have to do some stuff for that.
Perfect. I love it. That sounds like a very good and actually very well-rounded approach. And you mentioned periodization there in general, which is, in my opinion, the best way to go about things when you have multiple, perhaps almost conflicting goals as well, because so many people just try to do everything at once. And it sounds like you're not saying, well, in the month of February, I'm competing in jiu-jitsu and the Highland Games, and I want to be the strongest person. You're making sure that you're spreading that out in a logical manner. So I always think that that's often where people go wrong. And same applies to nutrition. Sometimes when they say, I want to work on longevity and just be very healthy, improve my hormones. At the same time, I want to be as lean as possible. And at the same time, I want to be as strong as possible. We're like, okay, well, we're
Right,
running into some problems here.
right.
But yeah, so shifting a little bit into the nutrition space, you also spoke about the importance of carbs and why they actually are so important for performance, but also muscle growth in general. Maybe you can touch on that.
Sure. Ketogenic diets and carnivore diets and things like that, you hear all kinds of people that go through that. And sometimes that's a good answer for a few people. But primarily, carbohydrates are the best fuel for performance that we have. And it also aids drastically in recovery because we have different protein synthesis avenues that outside of mTOR, like the GLUT4 transport chain, is pretty significant in how it helps protein synthesis speed along and help recovery after training sessions. And that's purely mediated by our carbohydrate uptake. So, carbohydrates, it's like, let's see, the old analogy is fueling yourself with fat is like striking a match and having a small flame. It'll burn that way forever, or having a candle. It's a small flame, but it'll go for quite a while. But carbohydrates are more like a blowtorch. You need that high intensity fuel for high intensity work. And I even break down, different forms of carbohydrates, like higher glycemic index carbs and lower glycemic index carbs, so sugary things versus not as sugary things. Things like brown rice and sweet potatoes, those healthier type carbs that we generally consider, versus things like Skittles or gummy bears or things like that. I try to equate those a lot of times to different kinds of fuel, like you put in a car. If you put a racing fuel into a low output four cylinder, Honda or something, Honda Civic from 1985, then that racing fuel is probably going to destroy that motor. And that's a lot of what happens when you have people who are not athletic, that don't do exercise, and they're eating tons of sugar. That sugar is the same thing as that high octane fuel, but it's just going to eat that the whole system up. And then you get diabetes and weight gain, and not to mention all the psychological effect that make them so satiable and increase your, the debate about whether they are addictive or not. They're kind of in that gray area where they don't hit certain markers for being in more of like a drug, and then some they do. So, and I think that also goes down to a lot of genetic variability as well. Everybody's going to be different levels of susceptible to that. But we have different times and different scenarios where all foods are good. So I try not to demonize anything. The best quote that I ever heard in my sport nutrition classes was, "There's no such thing as a bad food, just bad applications of food."
Yeah, and I think that goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning, just like learning about individuality and the situation right then and there. I can imagine that your food intake looks very different when you are perhaps competing in jiu-jitsu and you might to have to be in a certain weight class versus when you're wanting to be at your strongest for the Highland Games, where you're just like, I just need some fuel. I just need it to be really, really strong. So going back to the point of periodization as well, teaching clients that We can't pro probably cannot be the very, very leanest all year round, especially not if you have no muscle, but you want to build muscle and you want to have some shape as well. So we kind of need to look into that. And many of the people or women specifically listening kind of fall into that category of like fearing carbs or almost eating too little carbs, especially around their training. They might say, "Oh, I've always trained in the morning on an empty stomach. It doesn't matter." And then I am so busy, I don't eat my breakfast for another 2 hours, and my breakfast is like a protein bar or so. And that's sometimes I think the people that do need to hear like carbs, particularly around your training. If you want to build some muscle and get stronger, it absolutely your friend. But of course, nonetheless, if we want to be our very leanest, if we want to drop that super stubborn belly fat, sometimes we, or not sometimes, we need to cut calories from somewhere. So it is a little bit of a like, where do we pull from fats, carbs, and so on. But I assume you're approaching that from a very personalized perspective as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. People have all different puzzles that they present as far as, what their training history is, if there is one at all, what their genetics are, if they have, particular issues with different foods, which is always something to consider, their performance level overall. And basically you just have to talk to them. Be a coach. Like it doesn't matter what kind of a coach you are, you have to talk to your people and listen. You ask and then you listen a lot more than you talk, for sure.
I think that's precisely the thing that many coaches or people think that coaching means you just give them the plan or you just give them advice, kind of almost word vomiting all the information that you've learned over the course of the years. But if it's not specific to that person, it's going in 1 year and out the other year, if it's even going in at all. And I think, as you said, most of the time, actual good coaching is asking the right questions and listening. But yet, to the point of the stubborn belly fat, again, also, do you have any further tips aside from just being in a calorie deficit for how to get rid of those last 5, 10 pounds or so that are often so hard to get rid of?
Yeah, well, when you're talking about stubborn belly fat, most everyone has that as a problem area. And unfortunately, and I always feel bad sending this little bit of info to people, but problem areas are a problem by their nature because we store fat at different rates in different places based on our genetics and especially our hormones. So when we lose fat, we lose the fat relatively uniformly throughout the body, which gives you a really big problem. When you lose fat, it comes off everywhere. When you gain fat, it disproportionately goes in those problem areas. But sadly, there's no quick fix to that outside of a real sharp knife. You have to go through a much longer process and be patient, and you have to have fat loss phases. And ideally, in between those fat loss phases, you're able to gain some muscle. Improve your performance because your strength and muscle levels are going to highly predict how successful your next cut phase is going to be. We need to make you more resilient and robust as far as being able to burn calories, not just go do cardio and try to expend as many calories as you can. You're going to run into a brick wall there somewhere. If you lose too much lean muscle mass, you're not just going to stop losing body fat. You're exponentially more likely to have a gigantic rebound later, because when you go back to eating normally, then your body fat's going to increase on top of not being able to burn as many calories, but you've also created a large amount of insulin sensitivity, which will speed up that fat gain in general if you don't manage that correctly.
Yeah, I really wish I could like underline this point right here because yeah, I think that either just staying in the calorie deficit for way too long and or always sort of being in a low calorie stage, or as you said, just simply going back to what you were doing previously, that's kind of the two culprits that most people fall into. And you mentioned hormones, and I think that's really the big driver where we can actually optimize that, or where we can work on getting rid of that stubborn belly fat in the sense of sleep optimization, or even just sometimes vitamin D or something like that, stress management in general, those things that are often often overlooked, where people are like, oh, I just want a detox tip, or I just want that supplement. And then you go and tell them, well, actually, if you increase your sleep from like 6 to 8 hours or 6 to 7 hours, even, research is pretty clear that's going to make it a lot easier for your body to get rid of that midsection fat.
Yes, that cortisol related fat storage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to kind of round this off with, I would love to hear a few more training tips from you. So if someone is listening to this and they're like, well, I kind of feel stuck. I feel like I've hit a plateau with my training. I've been resistance training for, let's say, somewhere between 3 to 7 years or something, but I'm not really making any progress right now. What would you advise, whether that's nutritionally or training-wise?
Well, that's most of the people that sign up for my coaching, people that have been stuck and they're frustrated. I'm sure you've gone through the same thing with a lot of people. Periodization is really the biggest way and the most effective way to avoid that plateau situation, because you are setting up a timeline where you are taking not just training, but also nutrition to match the training over time, to where you are changing the stimulus enough over different periods of time, where your body never really gets a chance to settle into homeostasis. It's always being tweaked just enough, not too much, but just enough to continue having to adapt to the stimulus that's put onto it, whether it's a calorie deficit or eating for a little bit of muscle gain as well in a conservative way, to lower volume strength training or higher volume strength training, and all the stair steps in the middle of that. That's one of the biggest things that I do with my clients to avoid those plateaus, where I'd set things up in 4 week blocks just to keep things simple. And we'll focus on what's called a concentrated load, where we're going to do the same sets and reps for most of the exercises in that training block. Then, following training block, we'll change things, say, from 5 sets of 5 to 3 sets of 10. Now, the overall total reps isn't that much different. And the total volume might not be that much different, but we have research that shows doing sets of 5 versus sets of 10 has a significantly different stimulus. There's a lot more fatigue that's accumulated with higher rep sets. So it's not massively different. We're not jumping from sets of 5 to sets of 20, or we're not jumping from sets of 10 down to sets of 2, or things like that. We're stair stepping every block to where the stimulus is just different enough to avoid, bringing on a ton of fatigue and muscle damage because you're completely unfamiliar with what you're doing, to change it just enough where it's going to create a new training stimulus, push progress just a little bit farther. But we do that so long over time that the accumulation of the training effects and the adaptations, they really add up a ton.
I think that's a really great way to potentially or hopefully break through a plateau, because I believe most people are almost too focused on, I need to increase just the weight every week. So they might stick with the same program or do always the same amount of sets and reps and so on, but thinking like, oh, I need to put on an extra 2 pounds or 3 pounds or whatever, on that lift every single week. And that's just especially for upper body movements for smaller women or so. It's just not realistic. Like, I can't remember the last time that I've increased my weight for a lateral raise. Unfortunately, I wish I would have, but it doesn't happen that quickly. The increments are much too large in proportion to that size of the muscle. So I think if we work more with like rep schemes and changing things out up that way, and as you said, pairing it with the right nutrition. So if someone was to say, okay, yes, I'm buying into the idea of going into a gaining phase or whatever, in your opinion, what's a sufficient enough increase in calories past maintenance calories in order to see benefits?
So those things are very tricky, because I would love for diets and everything to be followed exactly as they are on paper. That way we could just do the math and know exactly what to put where. But unfortunately, we live in reality. We're no longer in the two-dimensional paper space that plan is written on. So it's not just, how well are people following the plans. There's that 20% variability just on what nutrition labels are as far as accuracy. So we never really know exactly what we're putting in our bodies, regardless of how meticulous we might be about it. So most of the time, I change the plan and add anywhere from, you know, 300 to 500 calories per day to aim for that surplus. But the big thing is, and this goes for any training phase of nutrition, you make a change and then you monitor the numbers for, at the very least for me, 2 weeks. 1 week isn't quite long enough to get outside of that daily fluctuation range to spot trends. 2 weeks is usually enough. We can find a regression line that fits what's actually going on with the body. So that's the biggest thing. You may write a plan that's 1500 calories and your client's accidentally taking in 3000 because of different things. They're not quite, you know, looking at the macros correctly. There might be a fat source somewhere that they're not picking up on. And I've had this happen, you know, write a 2000 calorie diet and the guy was taking in 3500 because he just missed the fat content in a few of his foods. So,
I'll actually share a small mistake that
yeah.
I just recently made, even though I've been tracking macros for nearly 9 years now. But I was using a log, like a new log for potatoes, and I used a raw versus the cooked, and I didn't pay
Oh,
attention.
yeah.
But I weighed them cooked, and I was thinking, like, in the last few days, I've been feeling really satiated, like more satiated than the time before. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's an extra like 80 or 100 k, because I eat a lot of potatoes. I'm very German when it comes to that. And it was like at least 180 calories or so on top of what I normally eat. And that doesn't sound like a lot to most people, but I noticed it. And again, like, I've been tracking macros forever, so if someone's new to the game, I totally understand if they miss the occasional sauce or dressing or oil or whatever, and all these things add up, definitely. So I agree with that. And would you generally increase the calories through carbs or fats or a combination of both?
That depends on what is low. If we're getting close to that low recommended fat intake level, just for health purposes, I'll always try to bump up fats as early as I can, regardless if the carbohydrates are very high or not, because fats are so incredibly important for joint health and hormone production and all those different kinds of things. And then once fats are raised up to an easily manageable level where we know we're not going to have a health deficit or performance deficit because of that, then we'll start focusing more on the carbohydrates. Once the carbohydrates start topping out, we'll start tossing in more fats again because it's just the easiest way to get more calories in. And that's usually only when we're getting up to like 4, 5, 6,000 calorie a day kinds of plans. So it's usually more about what can that individual client eat the best. And then we're always trying to figure out good food sources that work for them specifically, because everyone's stomach is incredibly different, for sure.
Definitely. And I think people have the hardest time with that, switching from a dieting mindset into a gaining mindset. Because if you come from, oh, I just want to eat as much food volume as possible to somewhat feel satiated in a diet, eating lots of cabbage and tons of vegetables and whatnot, filling foods, and you try to do the same thing while eating like double or triple the calories, well, good luck with that. You're gonna be very constipated. So it's more of a like, okay, how can I maybe switch the filling potatoes for some rice, which is a lot easier to digest, or less cruciferous vegetable than more like leafy greens or so, in order to make that easier. So yeah, I think that's a really, really great point. But Derek, I want to make sure I respect your time. So thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom with us. I'm gonna make sure to link all your social handles in the show notes for sure, so people can go and check out all your great content and perhaps even your coaching as well. So truly, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. The questions were terrific, and you're a pleasure. So thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Derek. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go. If you are looking for premium supplements, our partner, Fat Muscle Project, has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.